Good morning, everyone. I thank you, Sabina, and the committee for inviting me. This is a good opportunity, well, to show our work of 5 or so years. And this is the first presentation on a sequence of presentations about Florida Carbon. So today in the afternoon we'll have more, and tomorrow in the same room, same time, we'll have more on this, on other soil samples that were collected after these ones that I'll show. But Florida is a hydrologic complex region, and soil is very much a function of it, as you will see in the slides, and I hope the message gets through. This is the most up-to-date soil carbon map of the world that I found. The resolution is not great, but it shows this is total carbon, so it has soil carbon and biomass, and it's online in this address. Now, the authors also discussed that in very cold areas, in boreal forests, for example, and tundra, that kind of stuff, but also in swampy tropical areas, the carbon is pretty much in soils. Well, in rainforests, for example, in the Amazon, you probably have the opposite, that carbon is not in soils but in vegetation. But that said, Florida is a very swampy area, and therefore soil carbon plays a very important role in carbon sequestration and carbon management and so on. This is one of the maps that I'll show. It's based on state soil geographic stats goal. And the message here is that, well, as Alex said, soil carbon is very important for many reasons, but essentially it's an umbrella property that if you manage carbon, you're managing pretty much soil, and more often than not, you're managing the whole ecosystems, because everything boils down to what is in soil and what soil can sequester and so on. Florida has the highest soil carbon per area in the conterminous United States, and that assessment was made by Guo et al., 2006, and well, this is huge, right? The problem is that assessing this carbon, and when we talk about global soil map, this gets costly, and we'll propose some alternatives to assess this carbon regionally. Well, the challenge is that Florida soils vary so much, so they were mainly influenced by mull, by marine sediments, but also continental sediments in the north. So it is this mix of very sandy soils with very organic soils in swampy areas. So it puts a little challenge because, well, just the range of soil carbon is so great. But we have an opportunity that we found this, we didn't find this data set. This data set was collected, right, by NRCS and folks at University of Florida. And University of Florida Soil Science Department did some cleanup, and so I was glad to use this. So you see that it covers a big area of Florida. To move along, we complemented this Florida soil characterization data set with more sampling at this watershed that is in the central portion of Florida. Can you see the mouse? Oh. Well, it's over there. And the reason that I have 1,099, I filtered out some samples that did not have soil carbon, that did not have bulk density. So we did some cleanup to get the useful samples. Now, one of our approaches to rapidly assess soil carbon, and I'm thinking of efficiency and money saving, time saving, is to consider that, well, soil reflectance is a function of different soil properties, right? So you have different particles that attribute color to that one, mineralogy, organic matter, concentration of different materials and different constituents. If you think of it backwards, then you can use soil reflectance to estimate soil carbon, in my case, and many other properties. Well, that's the concept of visible near-infrared spectroscopy. So basically, you collect samples, you analyze in the laboratory, or that can be in the field. In our case, we did in the laboratory. We have some pre-processing, like oven drying and some grinding. And then we pre-process the spectra. And use that spectra relates to our observations, use many methods to estimate one property, in our case our carbon, based on the many reflectance values at this whole curve. And then we have model validation in the end. So this is what happens, and you see that, well, soils are a function of reflectance, and backwards, reflectance is a function of soils. And you see an example over there that different soil orders, for example, have different spectral responses. And these spectral responses are pretty are very much influenced by constituents. And I give some examples of water and links, chemical links at the molecular level. Now, when we did this at the watershed, at the Santa Fe River watershed, we got 0.86 R-square. That was the maximum that we got. And, well, this is not bad. When we did for Florida, in mineral horizons, we could do as much as 0.7. But in organic horizons, we could do as much as 0.3. Well, we had a much larger sample for minerals, but that also tells us that maybe information in organic horizons is not great. They're very dark. They are limited in terms of constituents, that maybe this very much concentration of organic matter is masking out some of the important information that would be found in the spectrum to relate to soil carbon. That's one hypothesis. We moved along to use the SCORPAN model, and now we added an age component, and of course this age component is pretty much a function of relief and climate, but it's so important in Florida that we want to call attention to it. And that in S is an example of a spodosol. That's a hurricane, and it's very famous in Florida, but one event like this can change soils dramatically. Of course, that doesn't happen everywhere and every time, but occasionally. And these are properties that we used to derive, well, spatial models. So we're going to relate those properties in the space continuum to soil carbon and try to predict soil carbon. We also rely on the fact that, well, properties resemble each other at close locations, and they get more dissimilar as we put them apart. And that's an example of an Everglades environment. So you see a gradation. It's not an abrupt change, but you have some plants adapted to water, and then you have some grassland, some trees adapted to water, and then you move along to the uplands. So you have a transition in vegetation. The same thing happens to soils, but just vegetation is a better figure so that you understand the concept. So we use this concept, geostatistics, and you're all familiar with that, to further improve our models and account for spatial dependence. We run variograms to do this. And that's the big framework of our soil landscape modeling. Essentially, we have a target variable. We first map that as a function of environmental covariates, and then we get the residuals and krieg them. We also try not to do environmental correlation, but go with only krieging without any external trend. And then we have residuals and invalidate the model. So essentially, our final prediction is a combination of the environmental correlation with the krieging of residuals. And this is what we got for the watershed. The patterns kind of resemble each other at different depths, and we would expect that because, well, soil is simply correlated along depth. But it will also depend, the patterns that you find, of course, also depends on the methods that you use and the variables that the model selected. So in this case, I'm going to compare here 1 to 100 that was mapped using regression krieging, and you see some resemblance with properties that were used in the models versus the one at the right bottom, krieging alone. You see the very artifacts of krieging, the bubbles and somewhat of a more continuous pattern. When we relate this pattern, I'm using soil carbon to 1 meter. That was in the regression portion, the function of land use, soil drainage, soil order, and sand content. And I'm relating those to some of the properties that it selected. Of course, it will resemble because one is the function of the other. But if I would put the map based on Krieging, you would see some resemblances as well. The message here is that, well, we have very sandy soils with very little structure, very granular form, but basically a loose sand. And when that happens, soil carbon does not accumulate. And those areas are preferred to be left alone. So then you have this correlation that one thing is linked to the other. You have a plain upland forest not used for anything in areas of very sandy soils that happen to be anti-sols. So all of these things are connected, and we hopefully get those in the models. In the other opposite, we have, for example, histosols, organic soils, and of course they happen to be in wetlands that are not used for agriculture, and then you have the intergrades as well. When we go to the state level, and here I'm using samples from the Florida Soil Characterization and different approaches. So in the first one, I used Soil Survey Geographic, which has a better scale, and the second one, 1 to 250,000 scale. Here's the Florida Soil Characterization map. Then I did block Krieging just based on the points alone. And in the last one, I get map units from StatsGo and get the average from soil characterization and apply to them. Well, stocks vary from as little as 14 kilograms per square meter to as much as 48 kilograms per square meter. And the big difference is in histosols. We had very few samples in histosols. Okay, over here. So they were kind of misrepresented, underrepresented by the Florida Soil Characterization. When here, we have this big chunk of histosols that add some bias to this estimate. When we start to extract information from these maps and we want to know, well, where is this soil carbon stored? Using the Florida Soil Characterization applied to StatsGo map units, this is what is happening. Here I have histosols. They take only 11% of the state, but they accumulate 40% of total soil carbon. The other big chunk is provided by spodosols that accumulate organic materials in the B spodic horizon associated with iron, pretty much. And it occupies 30% of the state. You'll see in the opposite that, for example, antisols, they take 22% of the state, but they store very little carbon, only 9%. So that's some of the things that we found. Here, I'll call attention to wetlands again, and they are linked to histosols, so this is really where carbon is. When we look at the soil profile and where is this carbon stored in the horizons, the O horizons, they store as much as 37-38% carbon, right? And this is not percent in the state, this is percent in the very horizon. Here's a picture of it. And when we stretch out the B horizon to take a look at the spodic horizon and the spodosols, they have as much carbon as the A horizons overall. So this is a big a chunk of carbon that is stored in the underground in Florida. Here you see this is my Maca soil. That's the Florida soil state, the state of Florida soil, sorry. And you see the big difference. After the E horizon, a big chunk of carbon over here. We also wanted to investigate how our models behaved as a function of extent, grain size, which is resolution, and then the location where the models were derived. And so we did this. We collected more samples at what we call the beef cattle station at the University of Florida. And complementing, and this is inside the watershed, So we further complemented sampling to take a look at the field scale. So we have a field scale, watershed scale, and a state scale. And as we move up to the extent, we increase variability. So for example, carbon goes up to 9%, then 17%, then 55% in the very organic horizons. We tested pixel size. So as you increase pixel, you decrease variation. As your samples, for example, they were located in very different pixels, they start to be located in the same pixel. So right here, you smooth variation, you pretty much lost information. So this is what's happening. As you aggregate, you smooth or you decrease variability. But we also wanted to see these are watersheds. These are hydrologic units. We wanted to see how models derived at different hydrologic units would communicate with other hydrologic units. Now, the idea is that, well, they are very different landscapes, environmental systems, and then environmental covariates. But at the same time, they have some resemblance. So can we trust this resemblance to build models in one place and then use it in another place? How representative would those models be? Okay, what we found for the extent is that the models decreased with a decrease in extent, and that, of course, is related to the amount of variation that we have to use in the model. But most important variables were soil-related, then hydrologic-related, and then a little bit of vegetation. In the watershed, hydrology dominated, and in the beef cattle station, only NDVI was selected. So it's pretty much a function of land use, but it explains very little of the total variation. When we apply these models, here's the field scale, watershed scale, and state scale. The model derived at the field scale was poor across extents, but the model derived at the watershed and the state level, they somewhat communicated with one another, but they were much better at the state scale. So even the one derived at the watershed, when it was applied at the watershed, it was not great. It was validated with 0.10 R-square. But when this model derived here, using only hydrologic variables, was applied in Florida, it explained about 40% of total variation. It's not great, but at the same time, it's a single variable, so we have some potential here. In the gray analysis, again, soil variables were mostly selected, then hydrologic variables, vegetation, and a little bit of topography, and that's across grains. As we expected, finer grains produced better models than coarse grains. And when we apply from finer to coarse grains, we see that, well, transferability decreases. But then the opposite trend was interesting too, that, well, models, simple models derived at coarse extents, when applied at finer scales, at using better pixel sizes, they behaved better when compared to the very pixel size in which they were derived. So we saw transferability to the better variation, I would say. Now, in the location analysis, I'm still trying to understand and explain some of these trends, because for me it's a bit erratic. It somewhat related to the amount of carbon, but not so much. Again, soil variables were selected, and then hydrology, topography, vegetation. But then when we cross-apply from one location to the other, we have this pattern. And I'm looking for some ideas to explain these patterns, some similarity indices. We're moving along with this analysis. But you see that some, for example, East Florida Coastal and this one, Coshawati Escambia, for some models, they accept these models very well, right? But, you know, the trend is really erratic. And the message here is that, well, you can only do so much with models that you derive regionally, and they can be applied at the same region. But when you apply to other region, well, you never know what's going to happen, right? We also, in that idea that we can use spatial dependence to explain some of the soil patterns, we extracted using field, watershed, and state samples pulled together a variogram at the short range that goes up to about 6 kilometers, and another variogram that goes to about 400 kilometers, taking the whole state. This had a Gaussian function, and that one had an exponential function. And then we tried some environmental covariates to see if they would resemble soil carbon spatial dependence, and some of them did. And this is the empirical semivariogram for example, saturated hydraulic conductivity and soil pH. So at the short range, they have some resemblance, and in the long range, they have some resemblance as well. But the variable that mostly related to carbon was available water capacity, well, the amount of water that soils can store. And that's function of carbon, too. So that kind of makes sense. But we can use that variable to explain carbon patterns. Here I show in red the cross variogram and in blue the semivariogram of available water capacity, and they resemble very much soil carbon. So that's our final finding to support that, well, hydrologic patterns are really linked to soil carbon in Florida. So my final words, I guess I'll be a little bit ahead of time, are that, well, spectroscopy can be used to expedite analysis and reduce costs, and we see pedometricians going forward to apply that in the field and see a lot of advancement in this one. Soil spectral libraries further improve current soil predictive models. So we have the potential to unite these things, right? Use soil reflectance to then map. Soil carbon patterns are strongly associated to soil hydrologic patterns in Florida. And, well, we had the great opportunity to have both the Florida soil characterization data set and, of course, SIRGO and STATSCO data. I wonder how this would be if we didn't have a previous soil map. So the relations would be completely different. And this is something that we can try to see. What variables would be picked up if we didn't have soil variables? Soil landscape relationships and models are affected by scale. I guess everybody kind of expects that, but attribute variations as well. And it is multi-scale, and that's also an expectance. And I'll finish with this observation. I'll read it for you. This is about subsidence, I don't know how to say this, in drained histosols in the Everglades, Florida. The post was installed in 1924 with the top of the post at the land surface. This photo was taken in 1975, and it shows the land surface approximately 4 feet below the top of the post. This represents a subsidence rate of about 1 foot per 10 years. Organic matter accumulation rates in histosols are usually measured in inches per 100 years. So this is a good example of how hydrology, the amount of water, is controlling soil carbon and how detrimental that would be if, for example, these soils are drained. And this is exactly what happened. And now Florida is trying to restore it. Maybe it's too late, maybe not. We'll see. Thank you for University of Florida, USDA, and all these people that made this this research possible. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
I can go back a slide and take a look at the pie chart. That would be my best approximation of, to answer your question. I don't know off the top of my head. You want me to show the pie chart of land uses? I don't know. I honestly don't know. Does anyone? Yeah, I'll go back to that pie chart. That will give you an idea. Just give me a second. Okay. If you consider, for example, urban and barren land to be like anthropogenically the worst case, that would take about 11 plus 2, 3, well, no, in parentheses, 12 plus 3, about 15%. Now, if you go with agriculture and rangeland and add them, you would have more, 27%, so about 50%, considering that wetlands are not used in upland forests.
Thank you.